everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. And here we are. It's the 18th of December, 2012. And I hope this finds you well. I'm actually on the road. Well, not at this moment, but I've been traveling and I'm in California. And after, it seemed like a day of driving, we rolled into Palm Springs where it's raining. And I was so happy to find Native Foods. It's a vegan restaurant. It's been around since 1994, and I was able to get a wonderful kale salad. And this is something I hope for everyone for the future, where you can drive anywhere and know that you can find healthy food. It's a start. Okay. Great show today. I want to bring on my first guest. One of the things we're doing here at Progressive Radio Network is we're inviting guests from other programs on the network, and I'm starting to do that today. I'm really looking forward to this first half hour with Ellen Cammy. She's the natural nurse. Perhaps you've heard her on the Progressive Radio Network. She has been involved in natural medicine since 1973 when she directed a program in ethnobotany at Conchise College in Douglas, Arizona. Dr. Cammy attended Rutgers and Cornell University, sat on the panel of traditional medicine at Columbia Presbyterian Medical School, and is a medical school instructor teaching botanical pharmacology. She was nominated for the March of Dimes Woman of Distinction 2004 and received the J.G. Gallimore Award for Research in Science. Dr. Cammy is a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild and is nationally board certified as an advanced holistic nurse. She's the author of many books, including Cycles of Life, Herbs for Women, which we will be talking about today, and you can hear her on this network on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Welcome to It's All About Food. Ellen.
Here as a guest instead of as a host.
Isn't it? Yeah. How does that feel?
It's great to be on the other side.
Yeah. Well, you are amazing. Is there anything that you don't do? You're on the radio every day, and you seem to be all over the place and helping so many people.
Well, I have been very intimately involved in natural medicine, actually, since 1964.
Wow.
So it certainly has been a very long time.
You've probably seen a lot of changes, some good and some not so good.
I can't think of anything that's not good, actually, in terms of the progression of natural medicine since that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a massive amount of growth. I certainly never thought when I was beginning to be an herbalist, I studied with shamanic healers in indigenous cultures around the world, and I continue to do so, except now, for instance, in this coming March, we'll actually be taking a group, along with any listeners who want to join us, to the island of Jamaica to live with indigenous shamanic healers there in St. Mary's Parish. And that's exciting. We've been doing that for 29 years, so that's
wow.
not new.
Mm-hmm.
But what's new is it is actually listed as a 3-credit course with Stony Brook University.
Wow.
And it is called an Ancient Global Studies course.
Well, there's so much knowledge out there that's beneficial, and a lot of it we've lost. And how important it is for us to learn about it from things that are going on all over the world that have been going on for thousands of years so that we can keep some of that really essential stuff going.
It is, and you don't have to go far. You don't have to go to the island of Jamaica. We do herb walks right here on Long Island. We do ethnobotanical eco tours for cures in Chinatown. We have one coming up in August. So no matter where you are, there is edible and medicinal plants, as well as kitchen remedies that most people have at home.
My first question is, what does natural mean to you?
Well, that's a great question, because that word is being used in a distorted fashion. For instance, Purdue Chicken says right on their chicken, natural chicken.
Yeah.
And so the word actually has no particular meaning. I saw a very interesting show just the other day with an attorney who is suing both Nestle, who owns Larabar, which is a supposedly health food bar,
right,
and another major company known as Kashi, and they're being sued for using the word natural on their label, because by using that word natural, it seems to infer certain things that consumers might think, which isn't really true because they may be using, in fact, unnatural ingredients as well as GMO-sourced ingredients. So that is a good question, and right now that's a question that's up in the air because there is no definition of the term natural.
Right. I mean, I know what it means to me, and I know what it means to a lot of people, but because there isn't an official or legal definition, people use it, and the public misinterprets it and gets misled.
It's true. But if I think about what it means to me, I would have to say something like I do in life, which is really eat things that are just in their whole form. Get medicine by walking outside the door and collecting plants and making it into medicine, as well as, of course, the higher level of botanical pharmacology where we really measure what the active constituents are. So I like every aspect of natural medicine.
Now, one of the things that has been a bit problematic in conventional allopathic medicine today is this reductionist mentality where we don't consider the body as a whole, we don't consider how different nutrients, different chemicals work together in order to achieve a certain goal. And as a result, people are focusing on specific nutrients, taking specific supplements, and not getting the best results.
Well, that's true, too, because when you're talking about supplements, you know, supplements will never bring you health.
Mm-hmm.
Supplements, the word supplement means you use it as a supplement. That means
in addition to.
Exactly, to fill in the blanks. And one thing that people might want to look at in their supplements are what kind of additives are there. Because if you look at certain commercial brands, and, you know, we don't want to mention them, but one starts with a C that I'm thinking of. If you look at the other ingredients on there, you will see things like benzoates. Benzoates disassociate into benzene. When they come in contact with vitamin C and other antioxidants.
Mm.
And so you want to look and see, especially in liquids as well as capsules, do they have potassium or sodium benzoate as a preservative. Then many regular vitamins have all kinds of FD&C, yellow dye, blue, green, red, all kinds of toxic chemicals within something that's called a vitamin supplement.
Yeah, there's so many things, and it's very overwhelming. But let's get to the subject we wanted to talk about today, which is a book that you wrote called Cycles of Life, Herbs for Women. And I have to say I have not read this book, but I would like to. And, you know, it's only been the last few decades where the medical profession in their clinical studies have started to look at women's health in addition to men's health.
And That's true.
Yeah, there's so much that's specific to women that we just don't know, for a long time have not felt comfortable talking about. And it's finally coming out there, but I imagine there's a lot of great information regarding women and herbs. I'm thinking about menopause, but all through life.
Right, and that's why I called the book Cycles of Life, because in this book I start out talking about menarche, and menarche is the start of the menstrual cycle, and very often that is completely ignored in our country, as being a big deal. But it is actually a big deal because it's the start of fertility, and in all ancient cultures, they had a lot of traditional rituals that they would do for girls as they entered that phase of life, and for boys also in terms of turning into warriors and being considered men. And a lot of that has just been dropped, which is really a shame because it degraded into more of just a commercial venture instead of something really sacred. So in my book, Cycles of Life, I do talk about some of the ancient techniques, and I know many mothers who have integrated that into their daughters, we call it the mystery time, the moon time visions, and how to do earth bonding to open the dream time doors. Now, you can actually use very specific herbs for that time. For instance, one is red clover, and red red clover is useful both at menarche as well as at menopause, and even during the middle years for things like PMS. Very interesting when we look at something called the doctrine of signatures, because the doctrine of signatures tells us, and all herbalists throughout history, that a plant will mirror in its form, shape, or color what it might be useful for. And when we look at let's say something like raspberry or even rosebud, for instance, we see something called pubescent hairs. Mm-hmm. And then we're linking it to the use during that period of life. Mm. So we see this again and again in the herbal kingdom.
If we would only pay attention and connect the dots.
Well, absolutely. And we do, you know, as herbalists, always pay attention to that as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, well, I know that there's a lot of things that are missed during that time in a young woman's life. It can be very, it can be frightening, it can be confusing, it can be embarrassing. And I personally went through a difficult time, and I just accepted it as normal most of my life until it took a turn for the worse. But that's another story. But the thing is, when I would explain my symptoms to doctors, they practically ignored me. They didn't know what to do about it and didn't take it as anything serious. I think there's more focus to that now. But I certainly wish I had had access to the Internet and your book.
Well, you know, the thing is that now herbal medicine, which is traditional medicine, mm-hmm. I'm very livid about the incorrect use of the word traditional. Traditional means medicine that has been used with great effectiveness and safety for thousands of years.
Yeah, this isn't a trend.
Correct. And
yeah.
It is also not correct to use the word traditional when we talk about conventional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You use the right term. So
thank
we
you.
Can call it conventional, we can call it allopathic, we can call it mainstream, and we certainly need it. As a PhD RN and an advanced practice nurse, I certainly do not want to throw out anything about conventional medicine, and it is often the appropriate therapy and the one that will save your life.
Yes.
Nonetheless, it doesn't mean that we should ignore the traditional therapies. So if you look at something like menopause, like you brought up, there's such a wide array of well-documented, evidence-based use of herbs such as dungui, vitex, wild yam, wild nettles, sea vegetables, and motherwort, just to name a few, that can help with menopausal symptoms and have little or no adverse effects.
Now, what about women like myself who have had total hysterectomies and have symptoms like hot flashes? Can these things help?
You know, in that case, possibly, because very often, even if a woman has had a hysterectomy, the adrenal glands will take over the production of hormones,
mm-hmm.
both estrogens, and of course there's many hormones if you want to be in balance, such as DHEA, DHEA sulfate, progesterone, pregnenolone, testosterone, and good holistic physicians will test all of those hormones, not just the estrogens.
Mm-hmm.
So the adrenal glands can take over the production of many of these things. So these herbs can help in that case, as well as a physical therapy such as acupuncture on the adrenal glands and castor oil packs on the adrenal glands. But if that isn't enough, I would then discuss, and I do discuss in detail in my book, Cycles of Life, bioidentical hormone therapy. And bioidentical hormone therapy is the use of hormones, but they're not the same as what's used in conventional hormone replacement therapy. They actually have a very different molecular structure.
I've heard different things about bioidentical hormones, and I know some people, after a bit of work, have gotten a great deal of relief, but it took some time to figure out the right balance that was appropriate for them because it's a very individual thing.
Well, all of healthcare is a very individual thing. That's right. So, yeah, using it, but it really can give some marked relief. Now, when people ask about the safety of bioidentical hormone therapy, this is the answer that they need to be given. It has been used for many, many years in Europe. In this country, I worked in a clinic where we used it for over 26 years with no report of anyone developing cancer. However, it has not had the same really in-depth safety testing that conventional hormone therapy had, and of course conventional hormone therapy failed. Mm-hmm. They actually stopped the study because of the large amount of side effects people got, including cancer, heart disease, etc. So, you know, while it appears that the bioidentical has a much better safety profile, it does not have the same rigorous safety trials.
I want to go back to young teenage women as they get into, they go into puberty and then they start their menstrual cycles. There are some drugs out today that will play with a woman's menstrual cycle, so that you only get it certain times once, I don't know, I don't pay attention to all these commercials, but some of them seem pretty horrifying to me. Do you have an opinion on some of these drugs? That
absolutely, they are extremely dangerous. And many of them that stop the menstrual flow altogether
mm-hmm.
are actually being recalled right now. I'm not even sure you can get them as a prescription
good.
At this time because
yeah.
they have caused many cancers as well as deaths.
Oh, my.
So it's
yeah,
a terrible
idea. I haven't seen those
idea.
Commercials recently. They were so creepy.
Yeah, exactly. And that particular drug, I think it's called Yasmin or something, really has been linked to a very high number and very severe adverse effects.
And how does something like that get approved and then get recalled? How does it get approved?
Okay, well, that's a really great in-depth show in and of itself. And, of course, Gary Null, this is the Gary Null Station on Progressive Radio Network, has done some very recent shows on how corrupt studies are
mm-hmm.
in terms of the release of medical studies and the people who are paid to do them, and the fact that when the outcome is not what is desired by the drug company, they just don't publish it.
Right.
So that's going on all the time. You know, even as far back as 1998, the Journal of the American Medical Association printed a very in-depth study, which has been done over with even worse numbers, showing that pharmaceutical drugs used as indicated is actually the third to fourth leading cause of death
yeah.
in the United States.
I heard that. Mm-hmm.
So there is really no link to the verification of safety just because of intense regulation.
Yeah, that expression, can't live with them, can't live without them, really means something when it comes to drugs.
That's true. Now, on the other hand, herbs are not 100% safe. People can have negative effects due to herbs. But, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been no death, not one single death, that has been significantly linked to the use of an herb. The only one that has come up in the literature was ephedra a few years ago, and that was with the overuse of ephedra along with recreational drugs.
Right. Okay. I want to get back to you're working with indigenous peoples around the world and their ancient knowledge of herbs and medicinal treatments and celebrating some of the cycles of life. What are some of the things that happen in some of these celebrations with a young woman who enters starts her menstrual cycle?
Well, it will very often be the lineage, the connection to your grandmothers. And there is an herb called black cohosh. It's very interesting to note that every time there is a shamanic or ancient folkloric tradition to an herb, like black cohosh, and we then study it later on with what we have now available in terms of high-class pharmaceutical type investigation of active constituents, we find out the active constituents that make this thing work. But when we talk about something like black cohosh, there is a spiritual component to its use in terms of bringing young women into womanhood. And this is how it goes. I collect black cohosh myself. It does not grow in the New York area, but it does grow in the Smoky Mountains, so you have to get it at the end of the season in the fall. And that's when the seeds that come up from the plant dry inside of pods. Mm-hmm. And if you break that stalk off and shake it, it becomes a rattle. And that's how the black cohosh was used. The roots were made into a tea, and at the same time, the seed pods were broken off on the stalk and used as a rattle. And the young women and older women, in fact, also drank the tea while they did rattling and singing and bringing in what they called the grandmother spirits to bless the young woman as she walked through the gates of womanhood.
We need more of that. We really need to celebrate all cycles of life, and we don't. And there's so much negativity surrounded with women going through this dreaded period that we have for so many years and how inconvenient it is, and then ending it, and that's even worse, going through menopause and all that.
I can't agree with you, though, because I loved menopause.
I'm not saying that's how I feel. That's the image that we're given.
I guess I never bought into that because I found every single cycle, like one, to be more exciting than the next. And certainly in terms of menopause, I would have to say that's been my favorite so far, but I always say that's been my favorite so far. But, you know, there's so much about it that I loved, like going through hot flashes for me was fabulous because I always was cold. So this was like, whoa, this is great. I'm finally really hot. And I actually took that energy field, and instead of making it annoying or anything like that, I brought it inside and used it mentally by putting it into my adrenal glands as a strengthening heat. And that was actually something that I learned from Mantak Chia, who is a teacher who talks about the microcosmic orbit. So, you know, it can be, I guess, annoying, but and you could say that we don't do rituals, but of course, in my classes, we have been teaching those rituals, and thousands of women have participated. If you look at somebody like Susan Weed, who you may have heard of, she's a very famous herbalist, and she has a center upstate where she's constantly teaching the coordinated use of herbs and rituals. So you're right, in our mainstream society, those are some of the attitudes that we're seeing, but we can take steps on a personal level to re-involve ourselves in the natural world.
I don't know where this tradition came from, but when I first started as a teenager, my mother hit me. And she doesn't know where she got it from, but that's what
her
mother
slap,
did.
Like slapped you. Yeah, no, actually, I heard of that. I'm sure my mother did that, too. Maybe it's a Jewish thing.
I don't know. It just scared me. Like, whoa, what did I do? What did you hit me for?
Oh, they never told you ahead of time to expect that.
No, it was just a really crazy thing. Oh, dear. Okay, so what else do we find in this? Okay, what about for older women past menopause, aging? You know, we certainly don't have enough respect for people as they get older, and we have a wealth of aging people today.
Right, and that's where I love this book that was written called Saging While Aging, and that's actually written by Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much loved the title of that. That's why I was drawn towards it, and I read it because of that concept of that older people actually have an enhanced amount of wisdom. Now, one thing that they need in terms of herbs are things that are nourishing. So for my older women as well as men, I would use nourishing herbs such as nettle, which you can just pick right outside your door anywhere, most places in the country, other than the desert in Arizona. Or, of course, you can purchase a product that is already made. Nature's Answer is one company that I work with, and I know they're really strong and powerful herbs. You can use nettle. You can use Siberian ginseng. By the way, that's no longer called Siberian ginseng. It's called Eleutherococcus. they changed the name. So if anybody wants Siderian ginseng, you call it Eleutherococcus. And another fabulous herb for overall inner stability and strength is rhodiola. Rhodiola is actually grown in Siberia, and that's a good, what we call, tonic to maintain the inner yang energy, the inner energy essence as we age. So there's a lot that we can do to feel really well.
Well, that's good. The only thing we need to change is how society looks at our aging population. But it has to start, I think, with the individual.
I've never been one to wait around and wait for society to change. I just always do what what works for me and teach, you know, really literally thousands of other people to do the same for themselves. And before you know it, voila, like I said, you know, now we are teaching these things within medical schools, which I never would have thought possible.
Yeah, this is amazing. I've been hearing interesting things lately where the American Medical Association has been removing some of the comments that they've made about certain areas of natural, different forms of natural medicine, which they originally considered a hoax or quackery, and now they're accepting it.
Well, even acupuncture. Acupuncture has become quite well established within mainstream medicine.
Right.
So you're right. You know, there's certainly a long way to go, and there's certainly a lot about attitudes that would be wonderful to move in what I believe is a more progressive venue. But there's no reason to wait till that happens. You can do it for yourself right now as of today. You can feel better. You can have more strength, you can have a more natural lifestyle and a nutritious lifestyle, like you said when you began your show about finding healthy food on the road. You're so right. It's great to have natural foods available, but since they're usually not and since I travel somewhere almost every single week, I always bring my food with me at all times.
Yeah, I certainly keep stuff with me too, but it's just such a pleasure when you find something that you haven't brought. It's like a treat.
It is.
I'm thinking, I got a kale salad, and I think it's a treat, but it was a treat. one last thing. We've talked about some important cycles, but what about pregnant women and babies? I'm imagining that that's an important time, too.
It certainly is, of course, and I do have many chapters in my book, Cycles of Life, on how to prepare yourself with herbs and natural remedies, both in terms of increasing fertility, in terms of during pregnancy, for birth, and during nursing. I was a midwife for many years and delivered several hundred babies at home because in those years, in the early 70s, you only had two choices. There were no natural birthing centers, which we do have more available today. That's another focus of progression. So you only had two choices, being strapped down, which is the worst way on your back to have a baby, or having babies at home. That was women's choices. So many of them did opt for a home birth so that they could have a natural experience. And there's a lot of herbs that you can use to help that, a lot of exercises that you can do ahead of time to ease the birth process, as well as increased milk supply. Some of the best herbs for that include something like marshmallow root. That's a nice one. And all kinds of nutritive herbs, again, like nettle, as well as very specific herbs like fenugreek. People know the taste of fenugreek if you eat those little fenugreek seeds.
Yeah.
So there's so much that you can do. Actually, having a good organic beer is a good idea when you're trying to nurse.
Okay. Well, there's just so much information there, and I want to thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and you have your program every Tuesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Your website, naturalnurse.com, is a place definitely to find a lot of great information, and your books, amazing.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to having you on as our guest on the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Happy holidays and Happy New Year.
You too. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Remember, responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my website, and there's wonderful information up there. I wanted to remind you, all of my shows are archived up there. If you just go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and go to the Real Radio tab, and you can scroll down to It's All About Food, the recent archive and the complete archive, you can be busy listening for a long time. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about peanut butter. Yum. Okay, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here it is, the 18th of December, 2012, and we are now going to talk about peanut butter. Do you love peanut butter as much as I do and as much as a lot of people do? Well, there's a great story about peanut butter, and we're going to talk about it today. You know, I say this frequently. Every food has its story, and it's true. John Krampner, who has had a lifetime on and off affair with peanut butter, is the author of two previous books, The Man in the Shadows, Fred Coe and the Golden Age of Television, and Female Brando, The Legend of Kim Stanley. He lives in Los Angeles and has a slight preference for crunchy, and his website is creamyandcrunchy.com. Welcome to It's All About Food.
It's good to be here, Karen.
Thank you. You know, when I first heard about this book, I just had to get it. And I enjoyed reading it, and I ate a lot of peanut butter while I was reading.
I've been hearing that from several people.
You can't not. You know, we keep reading about it, I want some.
Gotcha.
So one of the things I love about reading about the history of a food, and I've only found a few books like this. One was on tomatoes and one was on wheat. But what's fascinating about these books is how you really can learn a lot about history in general while you're telling the story about this one food.
Oh, absolutely.
There's connections to slavery and racism and poverty and wars, politics. What am I missing? Just about everything.
It does go all over the map, as you said. And just to give one example, Skippy Peanut Butter was founded in the depths of the Great Depression in 1933 by a man, Joseph Rosefield, out in Alameda, California. And originally, he had it envisioned as kind of a food for the wealthy, and but he wound up realizing that his true market were the people who needed it just for the protein to stay alive more inexpensively than they could do with meat.
Yeah, you know, it's a very similar to white bread, which was originally for those who could afford it, this hygienic, clean bread. And now, unfortunately, it's something that feeds only those who have very limited budgets.
Yes.
Where the more privileged can afford the whole grains, the organic, the more natural foods.
Absolutely. And
that's kind of similar with peanut butter, too.
And actually there are a number of interesting things about peanut butter, which I'm sure your listeners will want to learn, in the sense that, of course, peanuts and peanut butter are a very rich source of plant protein, which, I mean, that much I assume your listeners already know, which is why it's so popular among vegetarians.
Right. Well, as you probably know, I promote a plant-based diet. I'm a vegan, and peanut butter is a very important food in my community.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are some things that may be a little more arcane that you and your listeners might not be aware of, though. For example, there are two main ways of stabilizing peanut butter. One is hydrogenation, and the other is using palm oil in what's called the fractionation method, in which the palm oil is alternately cooled or chilled. To take up hydrogenation first, now I eat mostly natural or old-fashioned peanut butter. I don't care for hydrogenation, for all that, for the texture that it gives to the peanut butter. But the one thing that, as much as I hate to say in defense of hydrogenation, is it gets a bad rap regarding trans fats. There are some trans fats in hydrogenated oils, but it's a minuscule amount and of no real significance. However, the problems, from my point of view, with hydrogenation are, one, tends to muffle the peanut flavor, aroma, and texture. And secondly, and this really surprised me while I was working on the book, the main oils used to hydrogenate peanut butter now are soybean oil, cottonseed oil, and canola or rapeseed. Well, most soybean and cottonseed oil grown in the United States is genetically modified.
Ooh.
So people who eat any of the major stabilized brands or anything that's stabilized using these oils,
mm-hmm.
without realizing it, is eating GMO food. Now, because of the rap about trans fats on hydrogenation, which, as I said, is largely overrated, what some peanut butter companies have done, and this is really kind of sneaky from my point of view, is they use palm oil. They use palm oil to stabilize the peanut butter. And again, it's this fractionation process in which you alternately chill and warm up the palm oil, and you put it in, and that also stabilizes the peanut butter. This is marketed either as no-stir peanut butter or as natural peanut butter.
Mm.
What is the problem with this?
We were just talking about natural, that funny word that really has no definition.
Well, absolutely. Well, and it's especially, as someone who loves peanut butter as much as I do, to see peanut butter stabilized with palm oil sold as natural just
mm-hmm.
really chaps my hide.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, for the book, I interviewed this man, Frank Delfino, who had been both a plant engineer and plant manager for Skippy. And regarding using fractionated palm oil to stabilize peanut butter and then calling it natural, he said, that may be natural someplace, but it's not natural in nature. And but again, the problems with this fractionated palm oil, it's twofold. One, it's highly saturated. As a matter of fact, it's more saturated than lard.
Mm, wow.
It's a plant, but
that
it's
can't
more,
be good.
It's more saturated than lard. And palm fruit oil is even more saturated than palm oil. So anything that has on the label palm oil, palm fruit oil, or even organic palm oil, to heck with it. The other problem, though, is an environmental one, which is that palm plantations are being grown in the tropics to produce this palm oil, and they displace both rainforest and natural savanna. So both in terms of your individual health and ecological health, palm oil it's a bad bet, and so it may say natural on the label, but remember, it's not natural in nature.
Well, what's interesting is that those that have been manufacturing peanut butter were using the hydrogenated version, and then because there was some bad press, they found this alternative with palm oil. What's wrong with just natural peanut butter?
Well, the problems from general public point of view is, I guess to put it in a nutshell, people don't like to play with their food. It's
too much trouble to stir up your peanut butter.
Well, you know how we Americans are. We want everything convenient. We want it in
yeah.
a hurry. We want it now. But the fact is, I grew up eating hydrogenated peanut butter.
Me too.
And so to me, that was peanut butter. And then when I was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in the 1970s, I discovered Deaf Smith peanut butter, which is still a it doesn't exist anymore, at least under that name, but it's still just a nostalgic cult favorite among some of us. And I was like, well, this is kind of a little goopy and a little messy, but by God, it tastes good, and the aroma of peanuts coming off it, it's like nothing else. And so the main thing to do, because now I pretty much almost always eat natural peanut butter for the book as part of my research process. I did eat some hydrogenated again. But really, the main thing is just to, you do need to refrigerate it, because ordinarily the peanut oil will pool at the top, and then as light hits it, it will accelerate the process if it's going stale. So you put it in the refrigerator, well, actually it's the heat as well as the light that will cause it to go stale more quickly. So you put it in the refrigerator, you turn it upside down so that the oils and the solids just naturally remix, and you're good to go.
Oh, I haven't. That's something I didn't know. I need to be turning my peanut butter up and down, upside down.
Yeah, well, it really just it saves you the trouble and expense of buying a mixer.
I guess I could do that with my other nut butters too, and my seed butters. Turn them upside down. Okay, I learned something new, and you didn't include that in your book.
I believe.
I don't remember reading that.
Well, it's in any case, there it is.
Okay. Maybe I skipped it. Okay. So there's some intrigue, there's some scandal, there's all kinds of stories that are related to peanut butter that have gone on over time. One of the things that is so disturbing, I guess a lot of it began in the second President Bush era, when a lot of regulation kind of got loosened and companies were allowed to do whatever they wanted, and they foregoed a lot of safety.
Yes. It the operating political philosophy as far as food goes of the George W. Bush administration was what the Nobel Prize-winning economist who writes for the New York Times, Paul Krugman, called E. coli conservatism. And he called it that because the philosophy is they are so dedicated to there being no government regulation that they would rather have people get sick from E. coli and other bacteria and food problems than have food regulated. And you had two major salmonella outbreaks during the George W. Bush administration. The first was in 2006-2007. That was with Peter Pan. There were several hundred injuries. And I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it's something like for every reported case, scientists estimate there are either 28 or 38 unreported cases.
Right. It's always bigger than we know.
Yes. And then in 2008-2009, you had the notorious Peanut Corporation of America case in which seven people died that we know of, and more than 700 people were injured. And what's especially disturbing about that case is that emails have come out to indicate that they knew the product was contaminated, and they sent it out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, right now there is another ongoing salmonella contamination out of the Sunland Incorporated plant in Portales, New Mexico. And again, there have only been about 40 or so injuries from that case. Now, owing to the Food Modernization Safety Act that was passed in the wake of the Peanut Corporation of America debacle, when Sunland started to gear its plant up to start running again, the Food and Drug Administration now had the power to say, uh-uh, not so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And as a personal note, one of the things that bothers me beyond the more important public policy aspects of what's going on, of course, is that two of my favorite peanut butters were made at the Sunland plant, and so I'm really having a bit of a hard time coping at the moment.
Oh, which peanut butters are those?
Arrowhead Mills Creamy Organic, which to me is the platonic ideal of peanut butter, and Trader Joe's Crunchy Valencia with flax seeds.
Oh.
And it's interesting to note that both of those peanut butters were made, or are made, because I'm hoping they'll be making a comeback, of course. They're made with the Valencia peanut, which is a bit of an exotic in that most peanut butters made in the United States are made with runner peanuts, which are 80% of the U.S. Peanut crop. And they are, according to some people who are knowledgeable about the peanut industry, runners tend to be the blandest of the four peanuts grown in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been some recent varieties developed which are a bit more flavorful, but I think the critics would still hold to their guns on that. Then you get Virginias, which are about 15% of the U.S. peanut crop, Spanish peanuts, which are about 4 or 5% of the crop, and Valencias, which are grown only in southeastern New Mexico and the adjoining counties of the Texas Panhandle. That's only about 1 or 2% of the U.S. peanut crop. Now, it used to be that most peanut butter was made from a combination of Spanish, which are very flavorful because they have a high oil content, and Virginias, which have a lower oil content and thus counterbalance the Spanish and keep the peanut butter from being too oily. But starting around 1970, a runner hybrid was developed. It's called the Flow Runner because it was developed at the University of Florida, which it was a bit more tasty than prior runner varieties had been. And the peanut butter industry tentatively at first and then whole hog shortly afterwards switched to the runner because it's a very prolific peanut. It roasts very evenly, and it's less expensive. The about the only peanut butter that I found still made with Spanish peanuts, and this is a natural or old-fashioned peanut butter, is made by the Crema Nut Company of Columbus, Ohio. Now, there are two Crema peanut butter companies in Columbus, Ohio, and you know both of their peanut butters are fine, but the Crema Nut Company, they make a crunchy using Spanish peanut butter,
mm-hmm.
which is just, it's extraordinary, because most crunchy peanut butter is really creamy peanut butter into which some chunks have just been dropped after the fact, but the crunchy peanut butter from the Crema Nut Company of Columbus, Ohio, they just do a coarse grind. And so it's basically all these chunks of peanut butter just kind of mortared together with a little creamy Spanish peanut butter. There is one peanut butter that I found which is just made from Virginia's. That is the Koozie Company, K-O-E-Z-E, the Koozie Cream Nut brand. It's made in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I think they're making some Spanish as well as Virginia peanut butters now, so you'd have to check with them and be careful. But what's interesting about that, other than the fact that it has kind of a distinctive flavor of its own, is the creamy peanut butters today are, well, they're very creamy, but going way back into early peanut butter history, you had creamy peanut butter and coarse or grainy peanut butter. You didn't have crunchy, which didn't exist until 1935 when it was test marketed by Skippy in Salt Lake City. So this Kuzi cream nut, it has kind of a coarse or grainy texture, and it's just a, it has, I guess, what you would call a different mouthfeel. It's neither better or nor worse, but it's just interesting and distinctive.
Well, yes. Some people that are familiar with Whole Foods Market, many of those stores have a machine, and you can put your nuts in and make the butter right there, and it probably gives that similar coarse grind. It's a coarse grind, and I love it.
The I think it actually produces kind of a creamy, it's kind of a creamy texture, at least the ones I did it. But since you mentioned the grind your own, there is something I'd like to mention on that subject regarding health issues. This is the question of aflatoxin, which is a mold which can grow on peanut shells in the field, especially under conditions of drought stress, and which can, under some conditions, get onto the peanut itself. And as much as I hate to say anything good about the major corporate manufacturers of peanut butter, they actually tend to be the best on the aflatoxin issue. They, as a man who used to run the laboratory at Consumers Union, which publishes Consumer Reports, told me, in a bad season, the major companies will have 4 to 5 parts per billion of aflatoxin. A good season, 2 to 3 parts, which is as low as it gets. He said, you can't have zero. Peanuts are an agricultural product. They're grown in fields. And with the natural peanut butters, it's a bit higher. And but where it's the highest, interestingly enough, is the grind your own peanut butter in the health food stores,
where it
tends to be as high as 50 parts per billion, 50. Now, to put this in perspective, though, and this guy who ran the laboratory at Consumers Union said, look, if you were born in the United States in the last generation or two, your odds of dying of cancer are about 25% eventually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, because of the quality of the American diet, and of course, as we both know, there are problems with that diet, but compared to the third world, it's still pretty good. Even if, let's round it up and say you have a 100 in, I think it's, oh gosh, 100 in, a, I don't remember if it's a million or a billion, odds of getting contracting cancer from aflatoxin. He said that would still be like 0.001. So even if you eat a lot of peanut butter, and that means a lot of even natural peanut butter, your odds of getting cancer would go from 0.2500 to 0.2501.
Ooh, okay, so we don't have that much to worry about. And if you're really concerned, there are plenty of other foods that you can include in your diet that help boost your immune system and fight cancer.
That is correct, but I would still be leery of grinding my own peanut butter in a grind-your-own machine in a store.
Right, okay. We have a caller, Tom in L.A. You have some recommendations on grinding peanut butter?
I don't have a recommendation per se, but I do like peanut butter, and I wanted to know more about making my own peanut butter because I am a fan of it.
Well, actually, like you, I live in Los Angeles, and given the climate, you can grow your own peanuts here. Ideally, it helps to have a sandy loam soil, which I don't know what you have in your house or neighborhood, but you need to, the seed, of course, the peanut itself is the seed. Now, you can't use a roasted peanut. You can't plant that. It just won't go anywhere. So you would need to get some sort of seed stock in which, which to use to plant it. Let's see. Beyond that,
Pick this one up further another time because we're out of time. Thanks, Tom, for your question. And thank you, John, for writing this book, Creamy and Crunchy. I really enjoyed it, and I think I crave peanut butter even more than ever.
It was a pleasure talking with you, Paris.
Thank you. Visit creamyandcrunchy.com for more information on this book and on John Krampner. And visit my website, responsibilityandliving.com, for all kinds of healthy tips on great food. And have a delicious week.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Okay, bye.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.